We're beginning another week's worth of shows, and we have this morning one of those topics we do every month, and that's home maintenance. The guest is Hank Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He knows a lot about single-family homes and how they're put together. And if you have a problem, you have something needs to be fixed, you're thinking about making some changes, doing some remodeling, I think we can help you out. All you have to do is call in and talk with Hank and explain the problem, and he'll see if he can suggest the solution. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Good anywhere. You can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you just pick up the telephone and give us a call. And thanks for being here again.
Oh, you're very welcome. We enjoy it.
Just to start, I guess, we did have, last time you were here, we had a question come in by email, and I guess you did some thinking about it, and we're hoping that person is listening and you can give an answer.
Well, basically the question had to do with fastening down a kind of a carpet edge strip in a concrete basement floor that they claimed was so hard they couldn't get a hole in it.
Right.
Well, actually, one that I know will work is to use a powder-driven fastener. And you can rent the device that sets these things. They use a 22 or 38 caliber shell fire a hardened steel pin into it. And I don't think I've ever seen a piece of concrete that wouldn't go in. It'll go through quarter-inch steel with the appropriate load. And that will fasten things down. One that may work a little bit easier and perhaps be a little less expensive, there's a device called a TAPCON. This is a special hardened steel screw. A box of screws comes complete with the carbide bit for drilling concrete, and you drill a hole in the concrete, and then this hardened steel screw actually cuts threads in the concrete. And you can screw things down with that. Now, I've never run into a piece of concrete that I couldn't drill with a TAPCON, but admittedly, I have a hammer drill rather than just a straight revolving drill.
Yeah.
And that does make a big difference when you're trying to drill into concrete.
Okay. And that's something you could rent one of those, too.
Oh, yes, without any problem. And as I say, generally speaking, the box of TAPCON screws comes with a bit in it, so that you have the right size and so on to let it do that. The person asked about a mastic or something or other that you could put down, and I don't know that I would trust that in the long term.
Okay.
To do so.
Okay. Well, hope that person is listening, and I hope that helps. And if that person, of course, is listening and wants to follow up with questions, they can do that. And we have a number of people here ready to go. The lines are full, so we'll start right in. First caller is in Lovington, and that's line number 4. Hello. The caller there on Lovington, line number 4. There we go. Go ahead.
Yeah. This is a good day for you to be on. I'm wanting to re-roof my house. Is there anything special I should do, or should I just start off at the bottom and cut off the extra and go to the top?
Well, okay. Are you going to strip it back to the sheathing, or are you going to put a second layer over the existing roofing?
I'm just going to put a second layer on.
Okay. You want to be sure and start at the bottom with leaving about only a 3-inch strip. What you want to do is to set your new shingle so the top of the new shingle hits the butt of the old ones.
Okay.
So this is going to leave only about a 3-inch exposure at the bottom for the bottom row.
Okay.
And after that, that will make it lay much flatter. If you don't have a metal drip edge on, I would certainly get a metal drip edge on the bottom edge and a metal rake edge on the others.
Okay.
And you want to be sure that the cuts in the shingles on the new layer do not line up with the cuts in the old shingles.
Makes sense.
And beyond that, that's about it. You want to be sure that you use a long enough nail so that you get at least 3/4 inch of penetration into the wood below the shingles.
Okay. I got another question. I've got a dryer vent that exits through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
Would you have any suggestions on, I guess, specifically where I could get something? I've got a 4-inch regular vent like you'd use for a bathroom going through the roof. And since I'm going to re-roof it, I'd like to get something different because it just doesn't seem to be very adequate.
Well, I would think it should do the job very nicely.
Okay.
Basically, we want something that doesn't have a flapper in it that will get clogged with lint from the dryer.
Okay.
Because no matter what you do, there's always a certain amount of lint that comes through.
Right.
And so this will be one of those little hook-shaped deals that blows down.
Onto the roof.
onto the roof, yes. Yep. But that's about the best solution to it.
Okay. Another thing on that row, should I glue down the bottom row since there's no adhesive on the top of the...
Yes, that would be a good idea to use some regular roofing cement and glue down the bottom row.
Okay. All righty. Well, sounds like it's going to work.
Okay. Good luck. Right. And I guess it goes without saying, I imagine this guy probably knows, but it goes without saying that you got more than two layers of shingles on there. You can't put a third one.
Well, the building codes will let you put the third one, but we would never recommend it.
Oh, okay. Okay. It's because of the weight. Right.
Yeah, the weight and the fact that the shingles won't last as long because they can't dissipate the heat as well.
Okay. Very good. So we'll carry on here. The next person in line is Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I've drilled for TAPCON screws with a regular drill. And it takes a while, but...
Yeah, it usually works, but these people seem to think that they had an extraordinarily hard concrete so that you might possibly need an impact. Yes, I've drilled them with a standard drill many times as well.
My real question is, I'm curious about this exterior wall covering system that I see on a lot of commercial buildings going up, which seems to be made of a styrofoam base. And then they put some kind of
stucco material over it, yes.
Yeah, and so that they make it look like fake stone, and mm-hmm. They do all kinds of reliefs and so forth. I'm wondering whether that would work on my house, and I'm wondering whether it's worth pursuing. Has it been around very long? I've seen it.
It has been around, as far as I know, every insurance company for builders will refuse to insure any builder that uses it.
Oh, really?
It has been nothing but a major problem all across the country. It is even a couple of states have even written it into their state building code to prohibit it.
Well, they did it all along Green Street and Campus Town, I thought it was.
I'm glad they're taking care of it and not me.
So what's the problem with it?
The problem, if everything is done absolutely perfectly and all the flashings are done so that you never get any water behind it, it will work. It's been used on commercial stuff. It isn't nearly as durable as they would like to have you believe. I've seen it on buildings next door to schools and found that elementary kids can do a fair amount of damage to that surfacing. I've seen it on bars where thrown bottles have gone and broken the surface. Mm-hmm. But commercial contractors tend to be a little bit more particular as to how everything is flashed than residential contractors do, unfortunately. And as I say, it has worked some in commercial, but I would never recommend to anybody that they do it.
Well, that was sort of my gut feeling. I was kind of wondering. It didn't look kind of flimsy to me.
Several of the companies that started out making this stuff have since discontinued it. As I say, it's been prohibited by state building code in a couple of states on the East Coast. Insurance companies for contractors won't touch it. So that's enough reason for me to say don't use it.
Okay. That answers that. Thanks.
All right. Very good. Our guest this morning here in this first hour of Focus 580 is Hank Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program every month. We do this on a Monday to give you a chance to ask questions about home maintenance kind of issues. Anything that's on your mind, the kind of things we talked about here before, but we've also talked about lots of things, including, furnaces and air conditioning and attics and gutters and basements and doors and windows and just about anything you could think of. If you have a question, you can call us. We're here in Champaign-Urbana. If you're here, too, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that, 800-222-9455. And we have another Urbana person here in line next. It's line three. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Spies?
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call. I have another roofing question. I have a white asphalt shingle roof that was put on about 7 or 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
In the past couple of years, I noticed it's getting the dark streaks.
Mm-hmm.
Also getting dark streaks and build up on the metal, enameled metal strip that goes from the roof edge to the behind the gutter.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told that it's an algae or a fungus of some kind.
Usually it's a mildew type thing, and it often starts with deposits that our furry friends leave on the roof.
Uh-huh. And I was told that the solution is to spray it with about a 25% to 50% solution of Clorox.
Well,
will that hurt the roof?
It won't hurt the roof, but you'd better catch all the outflow from your gutters because it'll sure kill anything in the lawn below it.
Right.
That's probably the best way of taking care of the discoloration at the moment. The best way of keeping it from occurring, there is a product called Shingle Shield, which is basically a strip of zinc about 3 inches wide that you tuck under the bottom edge of the top row of shingles. And the acid rain that we get will wash down enough zinc oxide, which will kill the mildew.
Oh, I see.
You can use zinc. You can use copper, even lead. Any one of those three metals seem to work.
So zinc galvanized steel would probably work then.
Well, no, there isn't enough zinc there. These are zinc strips. They're not galvanized.
Okay. Are those available locally?
Yes. Yes. The homesteader stores carry them. As they say, the trade name is Shingle Shield, and it does work. If you live in Urbana, so as you go down Florida Avenue on the north side, you will see a spectacular example of how well it works in that, I think it's roughly an orchard. There is a roof there that we will see all kinds of dark things, except every streak below, every flashing that goes through the roof is clean. So if you want to see how well it works, they had copper flashings on there, and it has protected sizable streaks on the roof.
I see. I'll take a look for that then. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks. So if you got one of these things, one of these zinc or copper strips, mm-hmm. how long is that good for?
Life of the roof.
So 10 years, 15 years?
Yeah.
It'll continue to have that same chemical deal. The rain mm-hmm. will come down. It makes either like a zinc oxide or copper.
Zinc sulfate.
Copper sulfate. And then it washes down the roof.
It washes down and it tends to kill. Yeah. Now, there are some lichens that it won't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they're, generally speaking, most of our black streaking is due to mildew, basically.
Okay, very good. We'll continue here. The next up is Southern Illinois, line 4.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to ask you an architectural question. I promise I won't hold you to it because the damage is already done. But the question is, I got an older farmhouse, and it's made out of that rough oak cut. And it has a gable on the front end, and what it was it stuck out over the porch 8 foot, and there's a room up there, and I thought it was carrying some weight, you know. It may be, that's why I'm asking. I had 4 points within that gable there that it was sitting on. It had 2 columns on the outside, and they were built fairly decent, but in between there was 2 more, and it was just that thin wall inch steel, you know. I thought it was really holding something in the beam up there, but when I looked in that beam, all it is the false beam. It's 1x wrapped around, and it was just sitting there. And I built me a room and sunk it down a little bit because it was so high up off the ground, and I eventually want to go and build me a ceiling in there to hold that. But my question is, do you think there's a lot of weight sitting on there, or what? I don't know.
Without being able to see the framing, I can't really answer the question. I would think that, it's one of those things, you don't put a waterbed up there.
Oh, of course.
Something like that.
I just don't want it to come down on my living room I built.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only question.
Okay. It probably isn't carrying a lot of weight. It certainly is carrying some.
I expect
it's gotten by with a false beam, through here, you're probably all right because it's not going to make that much difference.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too. I mean, the damage is already done. I've already built the room, and I'm going to continue, but I was just kind of curious. I didn't think it was carrying very much. I appreciate your advice. Thank you.
All right, very good. Thank you. And we're going back here to Champaign for the next person here, line one. Hello.
Hi. Recently, I changed the insides of my toilet. I replaced the Balcott.
Mm-hmm.
And now, whenever I turn, every once in a while, the toilet will run for maybe 10 seconds and then stop, wait for a few seconds, and then starts running again.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens a lot when I turn on the water at the faucet.
Okay, basically, you apparently have a leak at the flush ball down at the bottom, and that particular type of toilet mechanism is designed so that when that leaks down, it will rather noisily fill back up so you know it's leaking.
Okay, this is the flapper?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
And so you're apparently leaking down at the flapper valve. And as I say, it's made specifically to be a little bit noisy so that when you get a situation like that, you become aware of it and can fix it.
Okay. Okay. All right. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. On to another Champaign person. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. I just want to make a comment about attaching the carpet in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
The cartridges that you have to use are special cartridges. They're not the cartridges you get from the sporting goods store.
No, no, absolutely not. It's a special cartridge for the powder-actuated fastener. Sporting goods store cartridges won't fit in it.
Right. I just want to make sure that people didn't go out there and try and do that, because when they say 22 and 38, they might. It is that size, but they might try and get the wrong stuff there.
They're blanks, and they're available in various charges depending on how big a pin you're driving and how what it has to drive it into.
Right. Thanks a lot, Hank.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, good thought. I guess, you wouldn't want people that like to go out and actually buy a 22
right.
that you would put in your 22.
Right.
No, this is not what we're talking about.
As I say, it wouldn't fit anyway, but.
Okay. Well, that's probably a good thing, too. Mm-hmm. Okay. Very good. To Princeton, line number three here. Hello.
Hello there. I've gotten two estimates on a new furnace and boiler. We have steam heat, and they're both 82% efficient. However, one is 165,000 BTU, and the other one is 115,000. And do you have any thoughts on why the great difference? And the 165,000 BTU unit is the cheaper one. So if you have any thoughts on that.
Now, you have a steam system, not a hot water system.
Right, steam.
Okay. Steam systems are peculiar in that the boiler size must be based on the amount of radiation, the size of your radiators, and you cannot size it according to the heat loss of the house.
Oh, okay.
Now, you should find on a steam boiler, it will say so many square feet.
Uh-huh.
And a heating contractor should have tables that show how many square feet of radiation there are for various types and sizes of radiators. And you have to have a steam boiler that has at least as many square feet in its rating as you have installed. Otherwise, there will not be enough steam. It will all condense out, and you'll never get any heat at the far end.
Oh, okay.
So this is peculiar only to steam systems.
Uh-huh.
Now, do you have a one-pipe steam system or a two-pipe steam system?
I believe it's a one.
Afraid of that. Okay. If you had a two-pipe steam system, I would be urging you to convert it to pumped hot water instead. Mm-hmm. But with a one-pipe system, there's not much you can do about it except use it as a one-pipe steam system.
Sure.
But that we've run into a number of cases where heating people... Steam is so uncommon nowadays. Today's heating mechanic, generally speaking, most of them don't know anything about it.
Uh-huh.
And if somebody sits down and does a heat loss calculation on the house and says, gee, we only need this smaller size boiler, it will never generate enough steam to get the far end of the line.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that is a peculiarity with steam systems.
Okay. Well, it's also interesting that the larger unit is cheaper.
Well,
you know, there might be other factors.
There may be some other factors on it, but
right.
Yeah, we've particularly run into the problem of this where you get a really old building and there's been a coal-fired boiler in it,
mm-hmm.
and then somebody puts a gas or oil conversion burner in it,
uh-huh.
and the burner is not big enough for the boiler, so that it does, the same thing happens. We're not generating enough steam to get to the far end
uh-huh.
of the situation.
Sure. This one had been converted, but the heat is very good, but it's only about 50% efficient.
Right.
About time to...
I would not want to put in a smaller unit than your conversion burner.
Okay, that's okay. Okay, maybe I can check that.
Yeah, your conversion burner should be rated in BTU, and I would not want to put in a smaller unit than that.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
All right, thank you. Well, we're just about midway through this hour of Focus 580. It's our monthly program on home maintenance, and our guest is Hank Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. If you got questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, the house I grew up in had had cast iron radiators and hot,
mm-hmm.
hot water heat. When my parents first bought it, it was an oil fired burner furnace, and then later on it was converted to gas.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder about, you know, that kind of system that is a circulated hot water, whether, you know, and why it is that now pretty much nobody
does
that anymore.
And nowadays we all want air conditioning, and it's mm-hmm. cheaper to put in an air handling system where you can both heat and cool rather than put in a heating system and a separate cooling system. So it's purely economics. Now, I go the other way around. I have a separate air conditioning cooling system, and I have hot water heat, and it is the best of both worlds. But I would not probably put that into a new house if mm-hmm. I was building it. It would be quite expensive to do so.
Mm-hmm.
My house had pumped hot water when I bought it, and then I added the air conditioning later so that we ended up with a system of that kind. So, but there have been a number of cases. What used to be the Champaign County Historical Museum up on University Avenue, someone put a conversion unit into an old coal-fired boiler there, and it was about half the size as required for that boiler, and they never were able. They eventually took the whole system out and put in a completely new system. It was just because someone did not understand the sizing problems with steam systems and put in far too small a burner.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, yes, if you calculated the heat loss of the house, it was probably 350,000 BTU, but in order to fire that boiler properly, it took a 700,000 BTU burner in order to generate the steam. And an improperly sized steam system has an efficiency approaching zero. So... we had that problem also with a church, which shall remain nameless in town, that had two boilers, and they operated them in parallel. Well, this did not work at all. This was extremely inefficient. What they had to do was switch them so that they operated one, and then if that one did not carry it, then the second one cut in.
Mm-hmm.
But to operate the two boilers in parallel reduced the efficiency to approaching zero.
So that it didn't add up.
No,
the individual mm-hmm. two things. It wasn't twice as much as
yeah.
as one of those. It was actually somehow less.
Yeah, the efficiency was of the boiler system was much less.
Okay, we have a number of other callers here. We'll just get back to it. Oak Forest, line number 4, right here. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I've been thinking about getting a Bosch tankless water heater that heats your water on demand instead.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The only thing I'm worried about is, do those run out of hot water?
Well, it depends on the rate at which you use it. In other words, there's only so much heat you can put in. If you turn on 3 hot water faucets, you may not get them all they'll be all the same temperature, but they may not be as hot as you would otherwise think. If you have a lot of things that may be used simultaneously, they're not a good deal. If you have things that are used basically one hot water appliance at a time, they work great.
Okay. Well, we very seldom use two things at once. So.
Okay. In that case, it would work fine. And Bosch is one of the few brands that I would recommend in that parts are available for them.
The other thing... is would you suggest buying a little larger unit than we really think we need?
Well, it all depends on what we're talking about, how many BTUs. You've got to have something that will give you enough hot water to fill your clothes washer, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on how many degrees you have to heat it. I would say you're probably looking at, 50,000 BTU, something like that.
Okay, thanks very much.
Okay.
All right, very good. Let's go next to line number two. This is back here in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm wondering if Mr. Spies can tell me anything about tiles made of recycled materials. I was visiting a nature center in Colorado recently, and they had a very handsome floor that... they said was made of recycled materials, and I wondered...
What materials?
Glasses and recycled in general. They said that these had been made a long time, and I was wondering where I might find out about them and who offered them and what durability and so on.
Without knowing a lot more about what's in them, I'm afraid I can't answer the question. And do I know any place that handles such a thing? No.
Okay.
I won't say they aren't made. I'm sure they are, and that we might be able to find one at a National Builders Show with some company who's trying to promote it. But that's something I don't think I've ever picked up literature on.
I see. Okay. Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Let's continue. We'll go here to line number one. This is also Urbana. Hello.
Did you say line one?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. It sort of blurped just
a minute. No, that's fine. Go ahead.
I'm just listening to your program as I do every weekday morning, and I'm just thinking how wonderful it is to be a listener of this station. Mr. Spies has contributed to the social interest of the community when he was at the Small Homes Council and then in his own private business. And just imagine someone taking his time to share this expertise free gratis. I just think it's wonderful to live in a smaller community that has this kind of opportunity for your listeners. And I just want to thank both the station and Mr. Spies for offering this program.
Thank you.
All right. Well, very good. Thank you very much. I mean, we appreciate it, too. He's been doing this with us for, I think, about as long as we've been doing this show.
Pushing 19 years at the moment.
So it's that's a long time, too. You know, I don't know that many other people in my life I actually see every month, you know, on a regular basis. We're glad to hear that you're getting somebody out of the show. And we have some other people here lined up, and, of course, we'll just keep on here over about the next 20 minutes. If you have home maintenance questions, this is the day to do it. Hank Spies is here from the Spies Home Inspection Service, 333-WILL or 9455 for Champaign-Urbana folks, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Our next caller is in Champaign. You're on line three. Hello.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Sure.
We have an old gas furnace for us that every year we think about replacing. And I have two questions about this. The furnace is underneath the living room, and there's a fan between the furnace and the central air conditioning unit that's outside the house. And my first question is this. Is there any way that a newer furnace would be able to reduce the noise of the fan, or would I be able to get any noise reduction from a newer unit than this? Because this is in the winter, this is really obnoxious when you're listening to music and things.
Yeah, I get one like that, too.
Yes.
Is that a problem also?
Yes, I do.
Generally speaking, the answer should be yes. Now, the problem is, as we try and make furnaces smaller and smaller, this means we have to increase the fan speed.
Mm-hmm.
And an older furnace with a slower fan very often makes less noise than a new one does because of the difference in fan speed.
I see.
And the other question is, well, first of all, probably your furnace is inefficient enough that a new one would pay for itself. How old is the furnace you have?
The furnace, it was probably 20 years old when we moved in. It's been up to maybe 40 years old.
Okay. It's one of those things where even if it works, you can't afford to keep it.
Right, right.
Because of the difference in efficiency.
Right.
But the main thing is to get something with a big enough fan so that it can slow down. Some of the new ones, we pick up a definite fan whine because of the speed at which they operate.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, this is more of a problem on cooling because we have to move about twice as much air in the winter in the summertime to cool as we do in the wintertime to heat.
Right, I understand that. Well, that isn't some for some reason that isn't quite as obnoxious as the as in the winter. Maybe I like to listen to music more in the winter. I'm not sure. The other question I have is this: is this a good time to be buying a furnace, or have I already missed the best time to be doing that?
No, it's probably still a pretty good time.
Okay. Well, great. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Well, just to pick up on what you said, I think with my furnace, I think the fan speed is the same in the winter and the summer.
Generally speaking, most of them are not. They have multi-speed motors on them, and when you switch from one to the other, you change fan speed.
Hmm.
It may be that you'd have one that is older than that it isn't a multi-speed, but generally speaking, it's an adjustable speed at least.
Okay.
And so that in the heating season, you can reduce the fan speed considerably. As I say, you have to move about twice as much air for cooling as you do for heating. Huh.
Well, I guess I'm just thinking about the fact it seems to make about the same amount of noise, whether it's summer or winter. And I've thought about that in my house, too, believe me. Yeah, it just seems to make an awful lot of noise when it's running. I'd like to have something that would be a little quieter. Well, we'll go on here to Bloomington, line four. Hello.
Yes, hi. I have an older 30-year-old oil-fired steam boiler. I don't know the size of the house. It's an old brick house. 3,000 square foot, but I've heard you mention a couple of times that if you were going to replace a steam boiler, you'd convert and go to hot water.
If you have a two-pipe steam system, if you have a one-pipe steam system, it isn't worth what it would cost.
Okay, and I do have a two-pipe that's a supply and a return.
Yes, you have two pipes going to each radiator.
Yeah. Now, why would you do it, and what are some of the problems involved? And is it easy to convert?
Well, it's not very difficult. You take out all the steam traps, and you take out what's known as the Hartford loop at the boiler. Basically, it's because a steam radiator only operates at about 215 degrees, whereas a hot water system, when you have mild weather, you can set up your system so that the water temperature varies and the radiator is only running at, say, 130 degrees.
Oh.
And it keeps the the rooms from overheating. It's a much more controllable heat.
I see. But as far as the cost of a unit, you know, a steam unit versus a hot water, are they about the same?
Generally speaking, you use the same boiler. It's just a matter of the piping and the pump.
Oh, is that it? So the unit's the same, and
yeah, the boiler itself is probably the same.
I see. What is that Hartford loop? What shape is that? What does it look like?
It's very difficult to describe without having a picture, but basically it is a system that keeps the steam boiler from going dry and blowing. I mean, this...
I see. Blowing out. I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. So,
Okay. To Bradley, next person here, line two. Hello.
Good morning. Thank you for this program, gentlemen. Sure. It's extremely valuable. We are newly minted snowbirds, and a little unsure about all of the things that we need to be thinking about when we're going to leave a house with the water shut off and everything closed up for 3, 4, 5 months at a time. Hank, what are the kind of things that we should be thinking about?
Okay, is your house basement slab or crawl space?
The house in Illinois is it's a bi-level, so where the lower floor is about, 30 inches below grade.
Okay, I would not shut everything down completely. I mean, I would antifreeze the traps turn the water off, drain down to the extent possible. But I wouldn't like to see the temperature in the house go below freezing.
Oh, yeah. No. We would leave that set at about 55.
Okay. Well, in that case, your basic thing would be, as far as I'm concerned, to turn the water off so
right.
in case a leak developed, you didn't flood the place.
Yeah.
And likewise, you turn down the pilot on your water heaters and that sort of thing.
And it's all right to leave that water heater on vacation mode or
pilot mode, just the pilot light? Yes, certainly it is.
Okay, there's just no way to lose any water out of the system where that becomes a problem.
If it's on pilot, that wouldn't, even if the tank was empty.
I see. Okay. Yeah. And you suggested one time about the... a little bit of mineral oil in the traps to keep them from beginning to smell.
Yes.
And that's a wonderful suggestion. We've tried that once, and it really worked. But it just seems cautionary to be walking away from a place and locking the door for months on end and depending on all the systems to function.
Yeah, the big problem is usually the toilet traps.
Yes.
Because if they freeze up, then you're going to burst the porcelain and... end up with water all over the place unless you have everything turned off.
Yeah.
Which I would certainly do.
That shouldn't be a problem at 55.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can buy a kind of a reverse thermostat. It sort of like works like an air conditioning thermostat where you can plug it into the wall, plug a light into it, and when the temperature drops below a certain setting, it will turn on a light.
Yeah.
So that one of your neighbors, if alerted to watch for us, if that light goes on, they know your furnace has failed.
I see. Okay, that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, they're about $20, something like
okay.
that.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your help.
All right. Very good. We have about 10 minutes left. Certainly time for other calls if you have a question. For Hank, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455.
It's probably about time to check the filter in your air conditioner. We're not anywhere near done the cooling season yet.
Mm-hmm.
We have quite a bit of August and September and such to go, but we've been running long enough that the filter may be pretty well loaded. So in interest of efficiency, do that. Also check the outdoor unit to see that you haven't loaded up the coil with, cottonwood fuzz, dryer lint, or whatever, so that we maintain the efficiency.
Very good. To somebody else here. We've got an Urbana person. It's line number one. Hello.
Hi. Can you tell us where to get those reverse thermostats?
I bought one at Menards not very long ago.
Thanks.
Okay. Over to Indiana. This is Cutler, Indiana, line number four. Hello.
Yes. Hello, Hank.
Mm-hmm.
Any ideas on how to remove dried latex paint from a brick house?
Well, you're going to need a stripper and perhaps a high-pressure washer, but you have to be very careful about those. Is this just a sloppy paint job?
Yes, it's a house that I'm doing that, honest, I didn't put it there. The paint's been on there. I'm estimating 10 years.
Well, actually, you know, there is a product on the market called Goof Off.
Okay.
That is designed to take off old paint that has gotten slopped on someplace where it wasn't supposed to be. I have never used it on brick. I've used it on wood. I've used it on metal. It works fine. I have never used it on brick. I have no idea, but that should soften it.
Okay.
And then pressure water blast or something like that should take it off.
All right. We'll give it a try. Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. So with that, is that going to work differently than strip paint stripper, for example, what you'd use if you're refinishing, furniture or something like
well,
that?
Well, it doesn't work the same way. And if you just rub it on wood and so on, you can get it off without taking the finish off, which the paint stripper would.
Yeah. Okay. But, so it depends on what it is you're wanting to do.
Yeah, just exactly what you're wanting to do. And as I say, it seems to work pretty well with the usual errors in interior painting. Latex paint essentially the same on the exterior. The main thing is to try it in some place, be sure that it won't permanently stain the brick.
Okay.
All right.
Homer, next caller, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could tell me I need some information. My daughter is planning on building a home, and it needs to be handicap accessible. And I know she does not understand all the things that are necessary for that. Where would I get specifications, or, you know, like how wide do the doors have to be, and how big does the bathroom have to be, and
well,
that kind of...
The Americans for Disabilities Act, the ADA, has a whole set of specifications on that.
Okay.
And you can get those probably... most any of the building code bodies would have it. I believe probably the university's Disabled Services Department.
Could be.
It was mostly written here for the national code. Most of the work on it was done here. And if they don't have it available, I'm sure they can tell you where to get it. There's a lot of information available on handicapped accessibility. The University of Illinois was in the forefront of this, been working with this area for probably 40 years at least, maybe 50.
Okay, now how do I start calling on this? Who do I call or who do I contact?
DSC, what is it? Disabled Services, something like that.
Would the folks at Small Homes be able to?
Probably not. Some of them might. You might try that as a point. I know that we've done a lot of work on kitchens for the disabled and so on, and some of which has been published, some of which hasn't.
Well, is there a number at the – well, if I look in the phone book and for under the University of Illinois, will I find something?
I think the Disabled Services, DSC, would probably cover it. At least they can refer you. There might be somebody at the Small Homes Council who can. The Small Homes Council number is 333-1801. 333-1801.
1801. And if they can't help me, why?
They may be able to refer you to somebody, but I know.
It's possible. I don't know. You might also try the U of I extension. The extension folks might be able to help. I don't know, but they, you know, they might be able to do that. Or you might also try one of the reference desks at one of the local public libraries. They're very good about finding that kind of helping people find various kinds of information. You might try that one too.
Okay, I hadn't thought of that.
There's a lot of work being done on so-called universal design at the moment, and this is basically designing a house that will be convenient for fully enabled people, but also can be used by the disabled.
Okay.
And I know that the National Kitchen and Bath Association has some publications on universal design of kitchens and bathrooms.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like what I would need, because at the present time, she doesn't need fully handicap accessible, but she's looking into the future in the next 20 years, and that would be necessary.
Yes, and as I said, there is, and I don't know, unfortunately, the exact name of it. There is an association for universal design, which is the current terminology for what we're talking about.
Okay. Well, you've been helpful this morning.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
I think we talked about this one time, and I don't know if it was you who came up with it. Somebody has calculated that within the lifetime of a family or within the lifetime of the house, that there's a very high possibility that there will be some person with a disability. It might even be just a
temporary disability. Yeah.
But it would be, that might make it difficult if you had a house where people had to say your bathroom was on the second floor and you had to go upstairs, or maybe you had somebody in a wheelchair and the doorways
we run into most often is that a builder often puts a 2-foot-wide door into a bathroom. Well, under this new system, the minimum size for a bathroom door should be 2'8". And we really like to have one bedroom and a bathroom with a 3-foot door. In that, yes, someone who has been in a wheelchair for some time can put a wheelchair through a 2'6" door, But the amateur trying it for the first time, he'd better have at least a 2.8 and preferably a 3.0. Mm-hmm. He hasn't learned to drive it yet.
And I think that maybe this also would help if the caller is still listening, that she might try calling the Division of Rehabilitation Education Services.
Okay, they've changed the name of the thing about three
that's
times.
That's right.
I think that's the one I was looking
that's
for.
That's right. That, yeah, this is 333-1970. 333-1970. That's the Division of Rehabilitation Education Services. And I think that, and here, these are folks that deal with people have learning disabilities, and they do physical therapy and functional training, and they have a prosthetic and wheelchair repair shop, and I would bet these folks would,
if they don't have it, they certainly know where
they
to
better,
get it.
They would know where to get it. So hope that will help. We have maybe if somebody wants to call real quick, we can get in a caller or two before we have to go. We talked about, you suggested that people check the, if you haven't checked your furnace filter lately, that would probably be a good thing to do.
Yes.
Anything now, it's probably still too, a little too soon to start thinking about the heating season. And I suppose unless, as one of the callers, you were thinking about new furnace, you probably don't want to wait if that's something you really want to do.
That you want to get to right quickly, because pretty soon the heating service calls will start coming in and backing up the dealers and so on.
Do you think that it's a good idea to have your furnace inspected every year? Or how often would you say?
Well, I usually try and get mine about every 2 years, but I know what to look for in the meantime. So it all depends. If you don't know anything about it, it's probably a good idea.
Okay. We do have one more person here. We'll get in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm wondering if you have any idea where I might find some replacement window hardware that is actually used to operate a wooden type shutter that serves in place of like a casement or an awning type window. Mm-hmm. It needs, we have one on an existing shutter. We have one that was removed before we bought the house. It needs a sort of a curved piece with a ball on the end, and you push that from the inside of the house, and it pops the shutter open, and you tighten a little thumb screw, and that's how the thing works. Do you have any idea where I'd find anything like that?
Well, okay, I have catalogs of such. If you would give me a call at my office, I have catalogs from two different companies that claim to make repair parts for any window made in this country in the last century.
Oh, great. That should cover it.
But unfortunately, I don't have that information with me. But as I say, there are two companies that one is Blaine, B-L-A-I-N-E.
Okay.
But I can't give you an address or phone number. I have 800 numbers for them.
Okay.
If you'll give me a call at 333-5048.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Very good. Well, there we must stop for this time around with the promise that Hank will be back next month, and we'll do it again. Thank you very much.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Hank Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's with us every month for these programs on home maintenance, always on a Monday in the 10 o'clock hour of the show.